Good evening, everybody. You have tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? Well, there's an awakening process going on the planet right now amongst us all. And our Paradigm Shifters are people who are making a big difference in the collective at this time. And I'm really happy to present my second interview with Aravinda. Aravinda is an amazing man with Semeticus sight, tremendous ability to see what the relationship we have to our universal flow, is that it?
Yeah, sort of that.
Welcome to the show, Aravinda, and then we'll get into what all that means in a few minutes.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's wonderful to be in your amazing place on Orcas Island. It's just a great setting for awakening, for expanding. So tell us what Semetica is, for starters.
Well, Semetica is a little different than what people might think of when they refer to readings or psychic abilities. It's quite different than a psychic ability. Psychic ability is often something that takes place when a person has the ability to sensitize their senses to this point where they can start filtering and tapping into these little impulses that arise through the unconscious. It's because the unconscious filters a superconscious awareness, or what we might call a transpersonal awareness, a collective awareness. We have a collective awareness that we can tap into information that's going on around the planet. And oftentimes what happens for a psychic is this collective information then filters through an unconscious, which in the East is called the Alaya. And by the time it filters through, if you're very good and very trained, or if you've had some kind of past life event that has brought that forward for you and you somehow manifested it into this life, then you can pick out little bits of information that are filtering through that unconscious, and it becomes information that you can then pass on, which seems to be what people call intuitive, or allows you to reach beyond the normal perceptual level that people have. Now, there's a vulnerability in that, and that is that the unconscious, which everybody has, unless you're fully illumined, is a kind of a polluted part of our consciousness. It's the area where we have all of our repressions, suppressions, all of the parts of our consciousness that we haven't been able to, or perceptions of life that we haven't been able to deal with very well. And so we've pushed them away, and they've created this kind of barrier between us and our really most developed, most evolved part of our consciousness, which is resting on really on the surface of our being. Hmm. And then we call that sort of the archetypal realms, or the superconscious level. Now, if that was available all the time, without the unconscious, we'd have all this wonderful psychic ability to see things that we normally don't, things that we typically erase because we become a very pragmatic race, humans, basically. And we've become oriented around the things that we feel are necessary for our survival. And so we've narrowed ourselves down to a sort of perceptual level that is within a certain frequency or a certain spectrum. Now, Semetica is a little bit different in so much as that you don't perceive through the unconscious. You actually perceive through a different facet of your own consciousness. And that facet is kind of comes from the top down. We all have different levels of consciousness. And Semetica isn't something you learn. You can't train yourself to do it. Like you can train yourself actually to be a psychic through learning how to become more and more sensitive, as you can train yourself to be a channel. And some people are obviously better at it than others. But Semetica is altogether different in so much as that it doesn't look from the bottom up into the light that's coming through the unconscious, the light of information. It is actually looking down on the light of information. In other words, there's a fundamental, in the East they call that the Aritambara Pragyam, or they might even refer to it as a Nabogana Akash. Nabogana Akash is this, what's called the vault, pure vault of knowledge, which sometimes in Eastern terms is referred to as Akash. Now, some people think Akash is, mm-hmm. they've heard of Akash, especially people that deal with spiritual matters. And they sometimes have the mistaken perception that that's a Western term, but it's a very ancient Eastern term that goes very thousands of years back in time, and it refers to a kind of ethereal body that we are all sort of tapped into. So we're all like these fingers of this hand. The hand is this ethereal body. And that's the nub about Gana Akash. And it's where all the frequencies that become life originate from.
Is it like a library?
Yeah, it's like a library, except you wouldn't find anything. Like some people say, well, I've read the Akashic Records. Well, you might want to question that. There's no books there. There's no writing on the wall. It's all, if you're in that experience, if the nub about Gana Akash, it's all direct knowledge, is perception. It's everything, you know, a quantum physicist might tell you that there is a single block of time, and then there is a perception that takes place within it. That perception is like a little lens that is moving over the single block of time. And that's where we are as individuals. Each person is like a little lens moving over this infinite field, which is considered this timeless field. So by moving over it, we create our perception of time, linear time. Now, on a level, if we were trying to understand actually, if we wanted to go back and say we wanted to really understand the nub about Gana Akash, it's all that information that ever was and ever possibly could be, but with an infinite number of variables.
I mean, the variables can be used at this point?
Yeah, they could be used
at this point. So it isn't like history.
People think there's a fate that everything is set in time. But we have to understand what the infinite nature that rests behind our human consciousness really means. When I say infinite possibility, we're talking about infinite possibility. People think that, well, everything is set, but that's not infinite possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you have an infinite number of choices you can make in your life, there's an infinite possible number of directions that the future can take. It's not like something is definitely going to happen. Even your time of death is not set.
Yeah, I've learned that, actually.
A lot of people
I want to jump back to Semitica. Like, so if we're, what you're talking about, and I go, okay, what do you actually see then? Do you see that whole field? Do you see for one person, for example? What do you see?
Well, it depends on what I'm looking for. Principally, I use it as a method for drawing knowledge. And it's kind of hard to understand for the average individual that every moment has a need in it. In other words, if this world was complete and perfect in every moment, time would stop. It would be done. Life needs an asymmetry for something to, it's like a wheel. You have to have a downhill motion. There has to be a lack. And every moment has a lack. And that lack is what keeps us going in life.
It creates a response.
And so when there's a lack, that lack wants to be filled by something. And since we are the ones that not only are sustaining a lack, we're also the ones that fulfill it. If we have the ability to listen for that need and then open our consciousness to that which wants to fill it, then we can actually pull and can distill that knowledge and then present it. That's a kind of, you could say, that's a one way of offering information. So
a manifestation, or you mean just an understanding?
It's a manifestation in so much as that everything that you say to some extent affects your reality.
Okay.
Also, but what you're bringing forward through Semitica knowledge isn't so much something where you're describing something or analyzing it. You said, what do you see in Semitica? You don't, it isn't so much that what you see, because all your senses are combined into a unified field.
Okay.
So it's a direct perception or cognizance. You have a direct cognizance of an absolute truth, and that absolute truth, which is a part of your own essential being, then presents itself against that variable of imperfection that we're living in life. You can see the contrast. The contrast in itself describes what is necessary, and then you can bring forward the knowledge to
feed that. What you see is the contrast and what's necessary for the person to achieve that.
Yeah, and then that perfection at the same time. The perfection in terms of what, like for instance, to look at you in Semitica, what I would see is your perfected being, your absolute nature. But at the same time, I would see your humanness, the frailties, the vulnerabilities. And those frailties and vulnerabilities are presented because you are actually living out your life one increment at a time. And there's another side of you, and that is that grand supreme being which is absolute in its nature. It has all of the truth, all of the knowledge already there. But by living through it, like this lens moving through this timeless nature, you are drawing forth bits of yourself so that you can live out your life. It's a perfect design.
So you can see the entire equation when
you see the entire equation. So when people find themselves in trouble, or if the world finds itself in trouble, which is mostly the work I do today, is I work on a more global level with people to help them find their place within this global structure that we all live in, because we're all unified, we're all one on an essential level, even though we're, you know, separated or diverse on an independent
level. Fighting or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But when you see that, when you can help a person connect to their place in the universe and their role, what we might call in the East is Dharma. Mm-hmm. When you can help that person find their Dharma, their relationship to the Supreme Being, then their lives align into a harmony. Mm-hmm. And so Smenika is really based. That's how I use it. In fact, that's perhaps the only way I really use it, is just to help bring people into that alignment. Because inevitably, everybody has something very important to do. Mm-hmm. You can't say just one thing, because as soon as you have a realization, it turns into something else important to do. And once you've got that realization, it turns into something else. So Dharma,
you say to do, it's actually expressed. Right?
Expressed, to manifest, to participate in, to bring forth as a realization. You've no doubt experienced in your own life, when you've had a realization, that realization isn't just for you. It seems to spill out from you and affect everyone in your life, you see. So we're all participating in this incredible exploration of possibility. And there are two possible directions we can go. We can go towards creating a destructive, uncomfortable, hellish life, or we can go towards a paradisical possibility. Well, we all know where we want to go, but we can get confused sometimes in the journey.
Well, sometimes the choices are so subconscious.
They are in the subconscious. Once again, I want to remind you in what I said earlier, subconscious is polluted. And so it's filled with our fears, the most seductive things that we couldn't deal with in life. And so they act like these little demonic little monsters in our consciousness that sometimes obscure the truth for us, because we are oriented towards safety, even though there is no such thing as safety in life. It just appears to be.
What are the pieces? Like, what is our karma? What is our personality? And, or let's just speak to that. What is our personality? Is that something that's really intrinsically ours, or is that?
Well, I think when you said the two words, karma and personality, they're synonymous. They belong together.
Oh, interesting.
The personality that you have is really kind of, we could say it's built of all of your experiences, all of your beliefs, everything that you've accumulated through life, your traumas, your successes, your failures, all those things combine into a kind of a mixture of things that you've hidden from yourself and things that you've realized your way through. It creates the uniqueness that you are and no one else anywhere.
But there's something intrinsic about my nature and how I would respond to those experiences.
Absolutely.
That I'm born with.
Completely unique. There will be nobody else like you anywhere. And
that's just as well.
Yeah. And it also could be wonderful, because that uniqueness means that you have something also very extraordinary to offer. And the key is being able to find all those little things that are blocking you, the things that are hindering you, this entire world. Every individual is to an extent saddled by the burden of their traumas or their resistances. And those are obscuring consciousness. And so their personality traits are, to some extent, I should say 50% of their personality is sort of carried by those shadows. And the other 50% is carried by the inspiration of that light that is constantly flowing through source. Yeah. Your essential nature. Mm. There's an immortal nature. There's a divine nature. And then there's the human nature, which is very frail. The divine nature will endure. Even when the human forms change, you could drop your body, you could die, you could fall away, but your divine nature will continue.
Which brings us back to the karma. Then we cart that along with us. Or can you explain karma?
Well, karma is an interesting thing in our world today, in the Western world, even though it's actually now in the Webster's Dictionary. it doesn't really mean, in the Western terminology, what it really actually was intended to mean in the Eastern Sanskrit form. Kadama.
As Webster might be the King James version.
It right? could be. Which, you know, that's an interpretation. Kadama is a simple term, but there's three levels of kadama. There's dharmi, dharma, and kadama. Kadama has two forms too. That's punya and apunya. But if you look just at the word karma, all it means is action or the ability to act. So it has everything to do with doing. Okay. And so a lot of people think that it's kind of a retributive thing that we carry with us. And that somehow if I do something today, I'm going to pay the price of that or get the benefit of that someday in the future. Well, certainly, everything's sequential. If I start building a house today, one day I'll have a house. It's much simpler than that. It's not retributive. But what it is information. It is knowledge. Everything that comes...
It's not a judgment.
Never. There is no judge except ourselves. But we've got that built into this sort of Christian-Hindu crossover that we've picked up in our Western sort of understanding of what's spiritual. And we've tried to bring in the combination of guilt, you know, and knowledge and say that we've got to be good or bad. Whereas the most ancient concept around good and bad and karma is that everything is bad is just as vital of a teacher as everything is good. Because it's as though when you're walking down a path, if you don't have the thorns on either side of the path, you could lose your way.
Right.
So the thorns are part of that experience that you have when you do something wrong. Inevitably, every time you do something bad, and you will ultimately integrate that experience, and you pay for the price. Not somewhere down the road. You pay for it immediately because you've integrated that experience. And then you use that knowledge of what you've integrated to somehow affect you later. Same thing for everything that becomes a realization, except on a much more powerful level. When you have a true realization of something, if something comes into your life, let's say a problem, thank God for problems because problems are the things that keep life going. If you do have a problem and it shows up in your life, that problem can actually be something when you accept it properly as a teacher rather than something like, oh my, I've got another problem, and use it as a teacher, it can empower you. Now, most people that are a little more evolved can actually understand. They've gone through the process of saying resistance is futile, really. You can't keep doing these resistances and expect to get anywhere. Once you start listening to these problems and you start looking for the solutions, you find yourself being empowered. Something starts to organize in your mind. You start to become wiser from it. You become more active. Your brain actually starts to expand. Your senses start to develop. Everything happens on a physical level all the way through into the deepest parts of your spiritual being.
Well, can that happen when you're facing what we would have called our karma?
Absolutely, because you're facing your karma every minute, all the time.
So we can neutralize it.
You can neutralize it through realizations.
Okay.
If you refuse the realization, it's like information that got into the machine but didn't get processed. And so it's stuck there. It's like, imagine you have a computer and this information is feeding through, but it doesn't ever get to actualize. The software breaks down. Well, until that actualizes, until that starts to come forward again, it gets stuck in your nervous system, or you get stuck in your memory.
And when it's stuck in your nervous system or memory, then you play it out over and over again.
Yeah, you do. You're affected.
So, for example, if it's an astrological chart with a configuration which is negative, could you use it the same way? Like, oh, here's a negative configuration that says people will always hate you or something.
Well, it's an interesting question because when you look at an astrological thing, you're looking at influences. You're looking at the what you call the dharmi influences. There's, when I said dharmi, dharma, and karma, you're looking now at the dharmi phase of karma. In other words, there are influences that are constantly baking in the background. And these influences are trying to work themselves through us as a species, through the world, through animals, through everything. It's moving the whole universe forward. That's dharmi. Dharmi is when the universe is in harmony and is moving forward beautifully together, like a perfect orchestration. It becomes when it becomes distorted in the world, like we are seeing a great deal of today, or we see the breakdown of our ecosystems, we see the disappearances of species, we see the wars, it becomes autotomy. And autotomy means something's gone wrong. The universe has stopped.
And it's collective.
Yeah, it's collective. The collective has stopped listening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, the collective is made up of individuals. So if the collective has stopped listening, individuals have stopped listening.
Mm-hmm.
And what they have stopped listening to is their part in this universal movement, which is called Dharma, the universe moving forward in harmony. And so it's like the orchestra, but now all the musicians in the orchestra are not paying attention to the conductor. They're all doing their own thing. And a lot of them, they're afraid of their own music. Or they're trying to get famous, and so they're playing too loud. You see, and so what's happening is they're creating chaos instead of harmony together. They're not listening to each other anymore. They're not connected anymore on this universal harmonic level, which is the Dharmi influence.
The Dharmi, and then I'm going to jump to this, is the fact that so many people are individuating or authenticating right now, moving into whether it's their cell phone and their PC and the electronics and all of that, is that also another part of the Dharmi? You know?
Well, I think it's an attempt to get back to this universal sort of harmonic connection. I think we're trying to link up because we inherently know we've lost something. Now, long ago, we could say we go through cycles. We're right now in a part of a sort of a collective humanity cycle where we've taken a dip, and now we're starting to come back out of that dip of illusion and trying to come back to our wisdom. We're missing ourselves.
It's interesting, is the Mayan calendar thing, and isn't it Maya that we're going to get out of?
Well, in a way, yeah.
Isn't that a funny thing?
Yeah. Well, it does have a kind of an interesting ring to it,
yeah.
But it has a different meaning.
I know, but it's funny.
Yeah.
The words are funny. It's like cell phones and cellular discoveries and genetics and cell. Cell is everywhere,
yeah.
Too.
I think we're trying to leave clues for ourselves.
I think so, too, yeah.
Yeah. But I think that one of the things that we're starting to see in this emergence is that people are actually trying everything they can to return to this unified understanding, this undercurrent of harmony. It's there. We all
see
it.
So that is Dharmi, is it?
What they're trying to do is they're trying to restore. And you know, we can look around ourselves. You know, we can look around in the world and see almost in every direction things are going wrong. Everybody knows it. Except those profiteers who don't want to see it, because they're still reaping the benefits of having things. You know, they're still taking.
Right.
See, the difference between a universe in Dharmi and a universe in Adharma, just like an individual in Dharma or Adharma, or a person that is creating negative karma, which is called apunya, or positive karma, which is apunya, is that the negative side is always believing that it is deserving, and it is always taking.
Hmm.
Now, you can take forever, but that's never going to be enough. Anybody that has done that path long enough knows it's never enough. You always have to take more. It isn't until it dawns in someone's consciousness that they recognize that fulfillment does not come through taking, but through giving. That we can feel it inherently in our hearts. There's an intuitive flame that we have in our hearts. And the moment we start realizing, well, let's just take the concept of love. We walk around and we say, I want someone to love me. I just want to find somebody in my life who will love me. Well, you can look and look and look. It could be somebody sitting right next to you and they love you, but you don't see it. You don't feel it. It's their experience. They're the ones that are fulfilled. You aren't, because you're looking for it. It isn't until you recognize that what you want the most has to actually be given away.
Hmm.
It's the nature. It's the generous nature of the heart. The heart is a creative instrument. And if the mind listened to it, felt what it wanted to give, it would find fulfillment. And so once the heart is there to be able to actually say, I want to give love, I want a place for my love to land without having to feel that I have to get something back. And when that happens, that person starts to align with what the universe is doing, constantly giving. And in that giving, they enter this current. That current is what is basically just the time. It's kala. It's the flow of abundance. And see, once the world realizes that true abundance, true fulfillment comes in through offering the gifts that a person is receiving all the time, like the light is on, touching into that light, tapping into that pure essential nature, which is this generous nature, then people find not only do they get the harmony, but they help fulfill the world. They help bring it back to healing. See, what we've done is we've come out of a culture right now where it's take a little bit more from the earth. Mm-hmm. Take a little bit more from the other person. Gain a little bit more control. Have a little bit more power.
And then you'll be secure.
And they think they are. But yes. The truth is, it could be taken away in a moment. And it is taken away in a moment. Everything will be taken away.
So you're talking about manifestation, which is the big chat these days, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. But what we have to be very careful is when we talk about manifestation is not to say, well, okay, if I do this, somehow I'm going to get everything that I ever wanted, because it's just another way of saying I want. It doesn't happen. And it's a very pure, simple, private thing that I think happens within every individual's consciousness in the process of awakening. There's a moment that arrives where you realize that you're here basically just to offer. And in that offering, you lay yourself open to the possibility. There's a real simple term for that. It's called humility. It isn't that you make yourself smaller, but humility, a different definition for humility. You accept anything's possible. You give up your arrogance. We give up that arrogance and say, you know, it's just like, I don't know. I just have to listen. I just have to return to this place of innocence. Just simple innocence. Not naivety. We've gained wisdom. We don't have to be naive like little children anymore.
But wait a minute. Does it mean that you don't have to know what you want? Like, you see what I mean?
I think that God smiles and the angels sing when you give up the idea of thinking you're going to get what you want in life. Because, you know, the truth is Supreme Being, this much larger aspect of us, this universal aspect of this knower inside of us, already knows what we ultimately need for our own fulfillment. The human mind, which is an instrument, it isn't the center of consciousness, but it's designed to serve the center of consciousness, the Ura, the spiritual heart of Supreme Being. It is an instrument that has been designed to serve, not to dominate or rule. That little instrument of the mind doesn't know what it wants. All it has is a simple reference of 30, 40, 50 years to go on, or whatever that person's learned, that little tiny, tiny speck of knowledge that it's learned in school.
If it's a reference, it's probably what's been around or what's happened or what's been in the collective.
It's not enough, you see. It's just not enough. There has to be, the person's in this world, and this is where we're moving. I believe the whole world is standing on the edge of that right now. We're standing on the edge of, do we continue to do it the way we've always done it? And then rely on our own egoistic principles, our own sense of what we think is right and wrong, or do we listen again and perhaps abandon some of those concepts, return to innocence, and listen purely. And
if innocence means releasing your identity as you thought it was important, right?
Yeah, and it's not an easy task to release the identity. But the truth is that when you stop, let me put it in a simpler term. Every illness, every psychological disorder is based upon who you think you are. That simple attachment to one's persona.
When we're trying to be who we really are.
Yeah, and that's not something that can ever be fulfilled. See, the mind tries to find an icon, something, someone, a God to serve. So we invent a God rather than recognize Supreme Being. It can't be invented, first of all. It can't be defined, can't be held or vesseled in any way. But we can listen to that divine will. If that divine will wasn't present, this universe wouldn't be rolling forward. Something is moving it. Something is making one moment emerge out of the next in an orderly temporal fashion. And if we can tune in to the most eloquent motion, if we can find that in ourselves, then we can actually become a very powerful awake being. We can
achieve mastery. So eloquent means being able to express without dissonance inside and...
Yeah, perhaps, I think perhaps eloquence can be best expressed when we have overcome our own ego, our own assertions as to who we are. Look at every problem of every culture, of every individual, of every psychological dilemma that's ever formed. In fact, every therapist's nightmare is finding somebody who is stuck on their ego. And unfortunately, our Western world has to some extent in psychological fields come to say, well, what we want to do is we want to get people to get to know themselves better. Well, that's a luck, because there is no end to that. That's just an endless line of therapy.
But wait a minute, there's something else, not for the individual. You knew when you were little what your... Okay, the knowing of who you were was beginning to be clear when you were small, right?
Well, actually, I struggled a lot when I was small, and that was because I was confronted with an open window into the Supreme Self, an open window into it, and being in a small body, a child, and wanting everything that a small child does without any guidance. You know, it's like you've got an enormous amount of information, a huge body of knowledge, but it's, you know, we're talking about university knowledge, and you're still in kindergarten on a physical body and mind. It was quite a contrast. It was difficult, to say the very least, very difficult to adjust to that. But as time goes by...
But did you know who you were? You know what I'm saying? Did you know you had a gift that had to be given? Did you know...
I knew that I had this gift, but I actually was a little ashamed of it. And I have to say the reason, well, because whenever I brought it forward to try to tell people something, see, when you're small and you have something like that, you don't know you have it. Mm-hmm. And so when I tried to actually share it with people, I would be to some extent kind of bending people's boundaries. And so I realized that something I was doing was creating conflict for other people.
Frightening them.
Keep in mind, people don't like change.
No.
In general, they like the safety of what is known. And I was in a very conservative area where that was very strongly recommended. This is how you live your life. This is who you are. This is what you do. And so when I started stretching those boundaries, even as a very small child, and I started seeing things, you know, I was met pretty strongly with, you know, that conservative opposition. And so in order to try to fit in, I actually had to change my awareness. It took me years. It took me almost 10 years to learn what to say and what not to say. And so I was quite content for the first half of my life not to have anybody know what I knew or what I could see. I was looking at people's lives. I could look back at their history. I could look at their past lives. I could look at their what's causing their illnesses. I was able to see so much, but I didn't share it. And the reason I didn't share it was because, not directly, the reason I didn't share it was because I was pretty happy being clandestine. There was a nice secret part of my life. I didn't have to bear the burden. I didn't have to bear the demand. I didn't have to deal with the conflict of stretching people's awareness in places that they weren't comfortable. So
That make you tense? Did it make you introverted? Or?
Well, it would have, except that I found that by the time I was out of high school, I opened my first school.
I remember you said that in the last time we talked. Yeah. So you were already using your Semetica at that point?
I was using it pretty much my whole life, but I decided to use it quietly, surreptitiously, behind the scenes. And so I would bury whatever I knew in other knowledge. And so, you know, I would do teacher training courses, and I would do counseling, and I had an herb shop, and I would create herb formulas. I didn't have to go and learn all the medicinal things. I could look at the herbs and work with them and see the fundamental reason for those herbs existing.
And that came through Semetica?
It all came through Semetica. Mm-hmm. So I had clients that were coming from all over the place and getting these cures for things. And in the process of doing that, I was always able to say, well, you know, the knowledge is everywhere. I put it together, and it was comfortable. But then one day arrived, and it was much later, and I was sort of, you know, it got to the point where I realized that I actually felt I was cheating myself and the world. I felt that hiding wasn't really as truthful. It's difficult when you have Semetica to ever not be truthful about anything. There's almost a kind of painfulness to it. And I realized that by not letting myself be seen or be available to the world directly, that I was cheating myself and the world. And it was, there was a sort of a shame that came up with that. And I don't want to live with shame. So
how old were you at that point?
How old was I? Probably, that was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, that would have been, I would have been 40. It's 40 years old.
We're making you reveal yourself.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't mind.
But it's actually quite interesting because it takes a lot of people a while to really come into what the embodiment of themselves in many ways.
Yeah.
Talents.
When you have something like that, and I've had it from birth, what I can say is it's extraordinarily rare. There's lots of wonderful psychics. There's some really very, very colorful and interesting channels in the world. But I've only met once other Semitic seer in my life, and that was in the Himalayas. Hmm. And it was such a relief. You yearn for that in your life because there's just something that happens where you don't have to speak in Semitica. If you can find another Semitica person who can see that you're not speaking but knows what you know when you know it, and you know what they know when they know it, and it's not the peripheral dialogue that happens within the mind. It's this spiritual, these little spiritual lights, these realizations that go on like lights twinkle on a Christmas tree. Like this, they pop up and you have the realization and you look over and the other person's having that realization. You look at that person's eyes and you see your eyes looking back at you. There's such an incredibly graceful moment of realization that occurs in that. Mm-hmm. And when that first happened for me, it was just extraordinary.
Really?
When I actually came across another person who was able to do that with me.
Did it activate your consciousness and soul?
He helped me a tremendous amount. He was perhaps the most, one of the most powerful masters that has ever walked in this world. And so when he did that with me, he showed me things that I didn't realize I could do with it. And so much of it still that I really hold back.
Let's just back up for a moment and get you to the Himalayas. How on earth did you get there?
Oh, gosh, it was quite a thing. Well, actually, not too far from here. I did a little forest thing. I was doing a forest retreat here, and I had a very powerful vision. And I had a manifestation of one of the masters who invited me to go to the Himalayas. Now, fortunately, I'm married to somebody who really understood that. And so she was really supportive of it. But I also, it was an affirmation of something that had happened 25 years prior to that. I was invited, actually, physically invited by, I met one of the masters in India when I was there, and he actually invited me to come back to the valley. I wasn't ready, and so I didn't know when the next invitation was going to come.
You said back to the valley.
The valley is the sacred place that, that very few people know of. Now, it's a legendary, you can find knowledge of it. It's legendary in so much as that it's very, very old. It's been around a very long time, for thousands of years. And it's perhaps one of the only places that I've ever experienced that is so pure and so filled with light. And not because of the space itself, but because of the masters that have walked on that ground. There's never been an act of violence that was committed in this land. And it's some beautiful, beautiful things that I learned about it. There were all these different ways of seeing that valley. But in the process of getting there, it was difficult. I had to travel to India. I had to use my Semitica to find my way 3/4 of the way there, more than that, probably.
You didn't have a road guide,
7 days.
AAA or anything.
Well, you know, I did hire a car driver that took me down at first because I had to go. I was actually being directed. I received a letter once I came to Delhi. And the letter actually prescribed a route for me all the way up until the Himalayas. It was delivered by the masters that I was on my way to see. A messenger left it in my hotel.
And so they knew you were in the hotel because of their own sight.
Absolutely. There was only two other people that knew I was in that hotel, and that was my wife and my assistant. And nobody else knew where I was in that hotel. So I was really pretty surprised to receive the letter, too. But when I did receive it, it actually changed my route. I had a completely different plan that I had come up with of how I was going to get into these upper central parts of the Himalayas, which are actually restricted or are not available to travelers. And it's very deep and very, very difficult to get to. And so
I just knew you had to go because of your vision and your...
Yeah, and the invitation, the second invitation was a vision. The first one wasn't, but my visions haven't ever let me down. So I'm very, fortunate for that. I've never really had a vision that's ever let me down. So they've always worked for me. And so in this particular one, I knew it was time for me to go. And sure enough, once I got to Delhi, I got the letter. And then I followed the letter down into Rajasthan, which took me out of the completely opposite direction from the Himalayas, from Delhi. And there I met up with the holy man, which I was meant to meet. And from that point on, then I went north into the Himalayas. I traveled through a few different countries, broke a lot of rules. I passed through boundaries I wasn't allowed to get into because I didn't have permits for. But I persisted. I literally went to the point of traveled through these mountains. You know, I by jeep, by pony, by foot, I got to the point where no guides would follow me or lead me any further in terms of, you know, helping me find my way through these mountains. I was on my own eventually. I finally came to villages where they'd never seen a white person before. And eventually I left even those behind. And it wasn't until I had finally come to the point where I literally had no other choice. I'd run out of food. I had become very cold because I was way, and I was traveling through these very dark, very, very high passes, thousands of meters up. And it wasn't, and I realized I was passing the point of return. I realized, if I keep going, I'm either going to have to find what I'm looking for or I won't make it back. And I chose to keep going. And so at that point, on the last day, all I had left was a little biscuit that a woman had made for me in one of the previous villages that I passed through, and a yellow apple. And that was it. I was in the process of biting into my last apple, and just shortly thereafter, I met one of the first of the Amartya masters who had come to meet me. And he guided me the rest of the way, which was an extraordinary journey in itself, because I actually traveled perhaps twice as far on that day from that point on than I had been able to in any of the other days. It was just being in his company was extraordinary. And he took me to through a variety of different twists and turns and unlikely directions into the valley. And when I first saw it, it was like coming home.
Wow.
Yeah, it was extraordinary.
And you have had other lives there.
I've had another life there. You know, it was really a lot of that was revealed there. I was actually a son of one of the masters that was still living. And I had left that valley in a former life. And that was, I'm going to say something that's a little bit outrageous here. Some people might find it difficult to understand.
Our listeners are accustomed to
it. So he was, it was three lifetimes, three births ago that I left there. And he was still there when I arrived, which can kind of give you an idea of their level of mastery. They're called Amartyas. Amartyas.
Amartya?
An Amartya master, Amartya Manushya, which means an immortal being. They mastered. You know, you've probably heard of beings like this before, such as through the Babaji, through the Yogananda tradition. Now, that's...
I've only heard a little bit. I haven't actually studied that.
Yeah, an Amartya is a being that has actually conquered death. In other words, they choose how long they're going to live. And it's possible. When you understand the fundamental principles, the science in our own consciousness, you can find that there are methods to be able to extend your life. It's not at all similar to the Taoist methods. It's purely through realization and the ability to remove all the obstructions in one consciousness. Now imagine there's no resistance flowing through your consciousness. There's no resistance. Nothing to wear down. Your consciousness is a pure vessel for this divine will that's moving through you on a day-to-day basis.
And this community is here to show us that that can be done and to add to the...
Well, in a way, they're very, very reclusive. They work on a global level. They work what's called their Jagad Amara Manushas, which means that they're world masters. They don't appear in the same way. They don't want recognition. They don't want fame. They don't want to be seen.
So you wouldn't have gotten any pictures, I'm sure.
No, in fact, my camera stopped working when I got to the valley.
Oh, wow. That's probably not a surprise.
It's not at all surprising because it was working perfectly up until that point. And it wasn't, and after I left, it was working again.
Right.
So when I did get there, it what happened was is that one of the things I was really careful to do was, I'm actually in the process of writing a chronicle, an entire story, the whole book of all the details of going there.
I'm very
and
excited
being
about
there.
That.
It should be out within a year. And
what's it going to be called?
The Undefended Heart.
The Undefended Heart.
Undefended Heart, yeah.
So defense creates death, probably.
Well, I think it's our essential being. If once we learn to stop defending our heart, we start listening. It's a risk that we all take. It's a difficult step because once you step really close to the heart, the first experience is perhaps pain. Maybe that's a kind of sadness around the unrequited nature of the heart. Because the nature of the heart is just to love unconditionally.
Hmm.
And when we come back to that, we've missed it so much that there's a kind of pain. And people will recoil and they'll pull away from it. They'll go back into their patterns and their tendencies. Because to step into love is to step into the unknown. It's to step into the unlimited nature. It has no boundaries. It has no enemies. Imagine that in our world.
No resistance to keep us going.
No resistance. And so to be able to be in that kind of a nature. No, in fact, that's the most fundamental definition of love. No resistance to the truth. And the truth is the truth of your own nature.
Have you been able to be in that yourself? And was this community, this small community of wise beings?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. Being there was perhaps the most easy, I would say the easiest place to be in that state. It's a little bit like stepping out of noise into this pristine and perfect silence in that valley. There's always a little bit of psychic background noise in our lives. We've adapted to it as a species because we don't hear it. But there's two different kinds of unconsciousness, two different kinds of unconscious that we have to deal with in our modern world. One is our own unconscious, which is the clutter of our denials.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the global unconscious, which is our collective clutter of denials, where it all meets together in this transpersonal field. That transpersonal field forms into what the East are called mayanavas, sort of pockets of pressure and tension. And those pockets of pressure and tension are things that are saying to us all the time, release me. Now, there's two ways we can release it. We can either move towards global healing or we can move towards a release through destruction. Either case.
Destruction?
Destruction. Destruction takes the form of wars, illnesses, famines, you know, it brings down destruction because the energy has to somehow use itself up. There's no resolution in the destruction. It all repeats itself again, generation after generation after generation. But through healing, through true healing, there's a resolution. And
do you think we're at a time of true healing on the planet?
I think we're standing on the edge of it. We're actually right now kind of in a free fall towards destruction. But don't let that sound like I'm saying that is a negative thing. It's an essential part of our own awakening. It isn't until people start to feel the lack of fulfillment from the things that don't work that they'll start looking for something else. There's this kind of don't rock your boat thing that happens in everybody, not just on a personal level, but on a collective level.
Mm-hmm.
If things are going fine, hey, everything's great. Why bother? Just reap in the benefits. Sit down, have a glass of wine, you know, have a nice dinner, go for a nice walk. But that doesn't necessarily lead to evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Life has two sides to it, and both sides are teachers. There's inspiration, but there's also pain. Both of these things work together. It's like a rose with thorns. You want that rose, you're going to have to be careful of how you deal with the thorns.
Do you think intrinsically we all have the drive to evolution?
Absolutely. It's our most essential drive.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, everything we do, everything, whether we know it or not, is an attempt to evolve ourselves into our awakening, into our mastery.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are just simply not aware of it. You see, it's something that comes about over time. It comes about through the maturity of one's consciousness. Eventually, when you finally figure it out, it becomes your reason, your only reason for being. You breathe in the inspiration. You start giving up a problem as being a problem. It's like it's another opportunity to see where the frailties are, where the fractures are in our consciousness, and heal them. It's a change. And I think we're standing on the edge of that.
I'll interrupt you just for a sec. We keep hearing that this is a time on the planet of conscious evolution, or that that's what we're learning. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. We've always been in the time of evolution. It's just that right now what's happening is we're standing on what's kind of part of what I would refer to as a kind of possible reincarnation of ourselves on a collective level. Mm. We are definitely
headed. That's pretty interesting. I like that.
Yeah, we're definitely headed for an impasse. We can see it.
We can see it.
Some people have already, many of the scientists of the world have already said, oh, we've passed the tipping point. There's no turning back. Mm-hmm. The thing is, we don't have to turn back. What we have to do is we have to learn how to transform these problems now into our teachers and use them and collectively learn how to give forth those talents that we've been holding back and no longer look for other people to create the solutions. Come to a realization that we are who we've been praying for. Mm-hmm. We are the people that we're looking for to solve these problems. And once we take that responsibility on and recognize that we have something incredible, every one of us has something incredible to offer, if we are willing to step through that place of pain that rests on the surface of our love and actually embrace that love, we have an infinite range or infinite field of creativity available to us.
Well, and for listeners, would you recommend that as a kind of a meditation for people to do? What would you recommend for people who want to speed up or hasten their awakening and the shift on the planet?
Well, my first recommendation, and of course there are all these wonderful things. There are wonderful techniques. There's meditation techniques, and we offer a lot of those. We actually provide a lot of meditation techniques that we brought together.
I've just come into phase two of mine, and I think they're just really powerful.
Yeah. And they're available. They're not. There's no price. There's no price tag on these. They're free. They're for anybody that's sincerely wanting to move forward. There's different levels. There's meditation techniques that used to be available in the world, and they were just considered mantra yoga or mindfulness yoga, such as Vipassana or other forms of mindfulness. These were all very beneficial techniques. Then there is what came along as well, maybe in conjunction with mantra yoga, is there was kriyas. Kriyas kriya is kind of like karma in purification. It's a preparation.
Kriya often causes a huge release of energy blobs.
They can, and it's usually dealing with spinal breathings or other forms of breathing that relate to releases. There's more kriyas available than just the kriyas that were available through the traditions that are most familiar in the West. And then there is something that's brand new and that the world hasn't yet seen in the West, and that is what's known as a pavana. Hmm. A pavana is actually known as, and I'll give you another term, which is these difficult terms, an ilayana. An ilayana is...
They're difficult, but Sanskrit, which means
Sanskrit,
they have a
because
sound.
There are no physical, I mean, there are no English terms for this.
But they have a vibrational impact
they
on
do.
It.
They do. They're almost
they?
Like a mantra in themselves. Yeah. The ilayana is what is referred to as the breath of God. The outpouring of divine will into the universe. And each one of us is designed to be a vessel for that. Each one of us is designed to carry that expression, that divine expression through us. And so there's a kind of meditation that's available, which is called the pavana, which you're now practicing. And that is that where you learn to
Wonderful.
Listen to those fundamental frequencies and allow them through no effort to go into deeper and deeper, sort of like a deeper pull through, kind of like what you would do with mantra yoga. You would, like a mantra is a sound, it's a frequency. We use these subtle frequencies, and combining it with your breath, like kriya and mantra together, you're actually able to go into very, very deep places within yourself until you find stillness. And when you find that stillness, you're sitting on the very surface of your being, the purest, most pristine level of your being, and from there you learn to manifest your reality without any of the conditions of the ego. Now this takes time, but it is perhaps now, today, the most powerful technique available in the world, in so much as the ability to take you there directly.
Okay.
Now, that does not negate any of those other things that are valuable, because there are many, many things that are valuable in our world today that people, different traditions are teaching. So it's not one of those, I'm not saying this is what everybody does. This is really for the person, these pavanas are really for the person that is matured to a level in their spiritual growth where they're saying, I'm ready to take that last stretch into my awakening, into my mastery. If the person's still holding on to their limitations, they're still comfortable with this, well, then the forming hand of God has not finished with them yet. There's still a work in progress.
But it sounds to me like I would like to recommend that the listeners pay attention to that, frustration or pain at the defended heart. Just pay attention to it, and maybe it'll move faster, and we'll have much more freedom.
Yeah, and that's the second part when you said, what would you recommend? I said, there are these meditations, but all of it begins with listening.
Listening, that's great.
Not speaking, listening, learning to, you know, when all the dialogue comes in, you know, it's all an offering. That is the karma. See, everything that comes back up as a thought through our mind, mm-hmm. or as a an inspiration or an idea, that's all our karma. It's the information that we have stored.
Right.
See, we store a memory in our body, in our cells. And if the memory won't get released, it'll become an illness. But if it releases and we start listening, it becomes our creativity. But before it becomes our creativity, because creativity can take two forms. We can become creatively destructive,
right.
or creatively moving towards healing. Our heart is the meter for that. We can feel in our heart the difference between sunlight and a shadow. And what I mean by sunlight and a shadow is inspiration or fear.
Right.
And if we actually work through a pure inspiration and we listen properly to what the moment is calling from us, and we are willing, without ego, to respond unconditionally, the moment we respond unconditionally with a pure act, our senses will light up. We'll feel this delight that starts rushing through our cells. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
See, it's this intuitive quality of listening that has to be married to the feeling nature of the heart. Listening and feeling precede the creative act, which brings about seeing.
Mm.
You see, our senses are designed in a very unique way. It starts with listening. Then we feel what we've listened for. Then we see the result.
And we can change the world.
And we can change the world with that.
Unfortunately, time's just about coming to a close. I want to ask very quickly. I know the ascended beings that are in the Himalayas, they're having an impact, aren't they?
Extraordinary impact. It's difficult to say just how incredibly powerful their influence is in our lives. They once said to me, I said, you know, how do you work with the world? And they said, we work with those beings that are on the edge of awakening. And they'll never know it. They can be in your life. They could be standing next to you and you wouldn't know it, because they don't work in the open. They find that their work is not hindered by the need to be seen. In fact, they can work much more powerfully through simple little bits of support. Although the people that have come to know of them, that have begun to communicate with them through themselves, have had extraordinarily powerful experiences, in so much as because they've recognized it. It's like you may feel this vein of gold there, but if you don't know where it is, it's one thing. The moment you put your hand on it, there's another experience. And it's like that with the masters.
That was going to be my question. So if you do the meditations and so on, you could possibly be conscious of...
They become more and more available to you, because these meditations actually come from that tradition that they live within.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I thank you so much for this time together. Would you like to tell people what your website is and how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, sure. It's we actually have a really nicely designed website that was created by a wonderful group of volunteers. And it's actually called Sambodha, Sambodha, .org. I almost wondered if I spelled that right. .org. And Sambodha actually means knowledge that affords itself when we are in the process of awakening. It's an ancient Sanskrit term. It represents something universal, something that everybody ultimately taps into. So we picked that name to represent our website. And that website has a lot of layers in it. People can go in there. They can see some of the work. They can see some of the structural knowledge, some of the art. They can see many of the different teachers. Right now, most of our work is in Europe. Where this year is actually the year we're committing to start stepping into the United States to make a lot of our work available here. We're really happy to say that there are some very powerful teachers now that have been trained in Europe that are taking over a lot of the work, and it's moving around in different directions. So right. It's in Austria, it's in Switzerland, it's in Germany.
And you've got lots of teams of activity over there, which we can read about and see.
Yeah, we have a lot of teams, and if
like
somebody's
community activity and service.
Community activities, service activities. We've got teams that are interested in trying to help the world on a lot of different levels. So, you know, just SEVA practices. You know, it is about giving. This entire network is about trying to find ways of supporting our world without the need and necessarily to have recognition. Everyone's standing on an equal level. There's no hierarchies. It's really designed to be something that is in service. And if somebody is interested in participating in something like that or wanting to know more, there is an information connection point there. All the people in Europe speak English that are involved with this. So eventually what will happen is we're going to create a sort of a boundaryless, you know, no flags flying kind of thing that we're hoping to work with.
If you speak German, it's a good place to go as well.
Yeah, that's it. So.
Thank you so much, Arvind. I've really enjoyed this. I learned
too.
A lot just interviewing you. It's great. Thank you.
It was fun. It was really fun.
Many blessings. Thank you.
Okay.